This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, A History of Nazi Germany, by William L. Shirer. I have often felt a bitter sorrow at the thought of the German people, which is so estimable in the individual and so wretched in the generality. Goethe. Hitler was the fate of Germany, and this fate could not be stayed. Field Marshal Walter von Brauchitsch, Commander-in-Chief of the German Army 1938-1941. 1,000 years will pass, and the guilt of Germany will not be erased. Hans Frank, Governor-General of Poland, before he was hanged at Nuremberg. Those who do not remember the past are condemned to relive it. Santayana. Forward. Though I lived and worked in the Third Reich during the first half of its brief life, watching at first hand Adolf Hitler consolidate his power as dictator of this great but baffling nation, and then lead it off to war and conquest, this personal experience would not have led me to attempt to write this book had there not occurred at the end of World War II an event unique in history. This was the capture of most of the confidential archives of the German government and all its branches, including those of the Foreign Office, the Army and Navy, the National Socialist Party, and Heinrich Himmler's secret police. Never before, I believe, has such a vast treasure fallen into the hands of contemporary historians. Hitherto, the archives of a great state, even when it was defeated in war and its government overthrown by revolution, as happened to Germany and Russia in 1918, were preserved by it, and only those documents which served the interests of the subsequent ruling regime were ultimately published. The swift collapse of the Third Reich in the spring of 1945 resulted in the surrender not only of a vast bulk of its secret papers, but of other priceless materials such as private diaries, highly secret speeches, conference reports and correspondence, and even transcripts of telephone conversations of the Nazi leaders tapped by a special office set up by Hermann Göring in the Air Ministry. General Franz Halder, for instance, kept a voluminous diary, jotted down in Gabelsberger shorthand not only from day to day but from hour to hour during the day. It is a unique source of concise information for the period between August 14, 1939, and September 24, 1942, when he was chief of the Army General Staff and in daily contact with Hitler and the other leaders of Nazi Germany. It is the most revealing of the German diaries, but there are others of great value, including those of Dr. Joseph Goebbels, the Minister of Propaganda and close party associate of Hitler, and of General Alfred Jodl, Chief of Operations of the High Command of the Armed Forces, OKW. There are diaries of the OKW itself and of the Naval High Command. Indeed, the 60,000 files of the German Naval Archives, which were captured at Schloss Tambach near Coburg, contained practically all the signals, ship's logs, diaries, memoranda, etc., of the German Navy from April 1945, when they were found, back to 1868, when the modern German Navy was founded. The 485 tons of records of the German Foreign Office, captured by the U.S. First Army in various castles and mines in the Harz Mountains, just as they were about to be burned on orders from Berlin, cover not only the period of the Third Reich, but go back through the Weimar Republic to the beginning of the Second Reich of Bismarck. For many years after the war, tons of Nazi documents lay sealed in a large U.S. Army warehouse in Alexandria, Virginia. Our government showing no interest in even opening the packing cases to see what of historical interest might lie within them. Finally, in 1955, 10 years after their capture, thanks to the initiative of the American Historical Association and the generosity of a couple of private foundations, the Alexandria papers were opened, and a pitifully small group of scholars, with an inadequate staff and equipment, went to work to sift through them and photograph them before the government, which was in a great hurry in the matter, returned them to Germany. They proved a rich find. So did such documents as the partial stenographic record of 51 Führer conferences on the daily military situation, as seen and discussed at Hitler's headquarters, and the fuller text of the Nazi warlord's table talk with his old party cronies and secretaries during the war. The first of these was rescued from the charred remains of some of Hitler's papers at Berchtesgaden by an intelligence officer of the U.S. 101st Airborne Division, and the second was found among Martin Bormann's papers. Hundreds of thousands of captured Nazi documents were hurriedly assembled at Nuremberg as evidence in the trial of the major Nazi war criminals. While covering the first part of that trial, I collected stacks of mimeographed copies and later the 42 published volumes of testimony and documents, supplemented by 10 volumes of English translations of many important papers. The text of other documents published in a 15-volume series on the 12 subsequent Nuremberg trials was also of value, though many papers and much testimony were omitted. Finally, in addition to this unprecedented store of documents, there are the records of the exhaustive interrogation of German military officers and party and government officials, and their subsequent testimony under oath at the various post-war trials, which provide material the like of which was never available, I believe, from such sources after previous wars. I have not read, of course, all of this staggering amount of documentation. It would be far beyond the power of a single individual. But I have worked my way through a considerable part of it, slowed down, as all toilers in this rich vineyard must be, by the lack of any suitable indexes. It is quite remarkable how little those of us who were stationed in Germany during the Nazi time, journalists and diplomats, really knew of what was going on behind the facade of the Third Reich. A totalitarian dictatorship, by its very nature, works in great secrecy and knows how to preserve that secrecy from the prying eyes of outsiders. It was easy enough to record and describe the bare, exciting, and often revolting events in the Third Reich, Hitler's accession to power, the Reichstag fire, the Röhm blood purge, the Anschluss with Austria, the surrender of Chamberlain at Munich, the occupation of Czechoslovakia, the attacks on Poland, Scandinavia, the West, the Balkans, and Russia, the horrors of the Nazi occupation and of the concentration camps and the liquidation of the Jews. But the fateful decisions secretly made, the intrigues, the treachery, the motives, and the aberrations which led up to them, the parts played by the principal actors behind the scenes, the extent of the terror they exercised, and their technique of organizing it, all this and much more remained largely hidden from us until the secret German papers turned up. Some may think that it is much too early to try to write a history of the Third Reich, that such a task should be left to a later generation of writers to whom time has given perspective. I found this view especially prevalent in France when I went to do some research there. Nothing more recent than the Napoleonic era, I was told, should be tackled by writers of history. There is much merit in this view. Most historians have waited 50 years or 100 or more before attempting to write an account of a country, an empire, an era. But was this not principally because it took that long for the pertinent documents to come to light and furnish them with the authentic material they needed? And though perspective was gained, was not something lost because the authors necessarily lacked a personal acquaintance with the life and the atmosphere of the times and with the historical figures about which they wrote? In the case of the Third Reich, and it is a unique case, almost all of the documentary material became available at its fall, and it has been enriched by the testimony of all the surviving leaders, military and civilian, in some instances before their death by execution. With such incomparable sources so soon available, and with the memory of life in Nazi Germany and of the appearance and behavior and nature of the men who ruled it, Adolf Hitler above all, still fresh in my mind and bones, I decided at any rate to make an attempt to set down the history of the rise and fall of the Third Reich. I lived through the whole war, Thucydides remarks in his History of the Peloponnesian War, one of the greatest works of history ever written. Being of an age to comprehend events and giving my attention to them in order to know the exact truth about them. I found it extremely difficult and not always possible to learn the exact truth about Hitler's Germany. The avalanche of documentary material helped one further along the road to truth than would have seemed possible 20 years ago, but its very vastness could often be confusing. And in all human records and testimony there are bound to be baffling contradictions. No doubt my own prejudices, which inevitably spring from my experience and makeup, creep through the pages of this book from time to time. I detest totalitarian dictatorships in principle and came to loathe this one the more I lived through it and watched its ugly assault upon the human spirit. Nevertheless, in this book I have tried to be severely objective, letting the facts speak for themselves and noting the source for each. No incidents, scenes, or quotations stem from the imagination. All are based on documents, the testimony of eyewitnesses, or my own personal observation. In the half-dozen or so occasions in which there is some speculation, where the facts are missing, this is plainly labeled as such. My interpretations, I have no doubt, will be disputed by many. That is inevitable, since no man's opinions are infallible. Those that I have ventured here in order to add clarity and depth to this narrative are merely the best I could come by from the evidence and from what knowledge and experience I have had. Adolf Hitler is probably the last of the great adventurer conquerors in the tradition of Alexander, Caesar, and Napoleon, and the Third Reich the last of the empires which set out on the path taken earlier by France, Rome, and Macedonia. The curtain was rung down on that phase of history, at least, by the sudden invention of the hydrogen bomb, of the ballistic missile, and of rockets that can be aimed to hit the moon. In our new age of terrifying, lethal gadgets, which supplanted so swiftly the old one, the first great aggressive war, if it should come, will be launched by suicidal little madmen pressing an electronic button. Such a war will not last long, and none will ever follow it. There will be no conquerors and no conquests, but only the charred bones of the dead on an uninhabited planet. Book 1. The Rise of Adolf Hitler. Chapter 1. Birth of the Third Reich. On the very eve of the birth of the Third Reich, a feverish tension gripped Berlin. The Weimar Republic, it seemed obvious to almost everyone, was about to expire. For more than a year it had been fast crumbling. General Kurt von Schleicher, who, like his immediate predecessor, Franz von Papen, cared little for the Republic and less for its democracy, and who, also like him, had ruled as Chancellor by presidential decree without recourse to Parliament, had come to the end of his rope after 57 days in office. On Saturday, January 28, 1933, he had been abruptly dismissed by the aging President of the Republic, Field Marshal von Hindenburg. Adolf Hitler, leader of the National Socialists, the largest political party in Germany, was demanding for himself the chancellorship of the Democratic Republic he had sworn to destroy. The wildest rumors of what might happen were rife in the capital that fateful winter weekend, and the most alarming of them, as it happened, were not without some foundation. There were reports that Schleicher, in collusion with General Kurt von Hammerstein, the commander-in-chief of the army, was preparing a putsch, with the support of the Potsdam garrison, for the purpose of arresting the president and establishing a military dictatorship. There was talk of a Nazi putsch. The Berlin stormtroopers, aided by Nazi sympathizers in the police, were to seize the Wilhelmstrasse, where the president's palace and most of the government ministries were located. There was talk also of a general strike. On Sunday, January 29th, 100,000 workers crowded into the Lustgarten in the center of Berlin to demonstrate their opposition to making Hitler chancellor. One of their leaders attempted to get in touch with General von Hammerstein to propose joint action by the army and organized labor, should Hitler be named to head a new government. Once before, at the time of the Kapp Putsch in 1920, a general strike had saved the Republic after the government had fled the capital. Throughout most of the night from Sunday to Monday, Hitler paced up and down in his room in the Kaiserhof Hotel on the Reichskanzlerplatz, just down the street from the Chancellery. Despite his nervousness, he was supremely confident that his hour had struck. For nearly a month he had been secretly negotiating with Papen and the other leaders of the conservative right. He had had to compromise. He could not have a purely Nazi government. But he could be chancellor of a coalition government whose members, 8 out of 11 of whom were not Nazis, agreed with him on the abolition of the democratic Weimar regime. Only the aged Dürer president had seemed to stand in his way. As recently as January 26th, 2 days before the advent of this crucial weekend, the grisly old field marshal had told General von Hammerstein that he had no intention whatsoever of making that Austrian corporal either Minister of Defense or Chancellor of the Reich. Yet under the influence of his son, Major Oskar von Hindenburg, of Otto von Meissner, the State Secretary to the President, of Papen and other members of the Palace Camarilla, the President was finally weakening. He was 86 and fading into senility. On the afternoon of Sunday, January 29th, while Hitler was having coffee and cakes with Goebbels and other aides, Hermann Göring, president of the Reichstag and second to Hitler in the Nazi Party, burst in and informed them categorically that on the morrow Hitler would be named chancellor. Shortly before noon on Monday, January 30th, 1933, Hitler drove over to the Chancellery for an interview with Hindenburg that was to prove fateful for himself, for Germany, and for the rest of the world. From a window in the Kaiserhof, Goebbels, Röhm, and other Nazi chiefs kept an anxious watch on the door of the Chancellery, where the Führer would shortly be coming out. "We would see from his face whether he had succeeded or not," Goebbels noted. For even then they were not quite sure. "Our hearts are torn back and forth between doubt, hope, joy, and discouragement," Goebbels jotted down in his diary. "We have been disappointed too often for us to believe wholeheartedly in the great miracle." A few moments later, they witnessed the miracle. The man with the Charlie Chaplin mustache, who had been a down-and-out tramp in Vienna in his youth, an unknown soldier of World War I, a derelict in Munich in the first grim post-war days, the somewhat comical leader of the beer hall putsch, this spellbinder who was not even German but Austrian, and who was only 43 years old, had just been administered the oath as Chancellor of the German Reich. He drove the 100 yards to the Kaiserhof and was soon with his old cronies, Goebbels, Göring, Röhm, and the other brown shirts who had helped him along the rocky, brawling path to power. "He says nothing, and all of us say nothing," Goebbels recorded, "but his eyes are full of tears." That evening, from dusk until far past midnight, the delirious Nazi stormtroopers marched in a massive torchlight parade to celebrate the victory. By the tens of thousands, they emerged in disciplined columns from the depths of the Tiergarten, passed under the triumphal arch of the Brandenburg Gate and down the Wilhelmstrasse, their bands blaring the old martial airs to the thunderous beating of the drums, their voices bawling the new Horst Wessel song and other tunes that were as old as Germany, their jackboots beating a mighty rhythm on the pavement, their torches held high and forming a ribbon of flame that illuminated the night and kindled the hurrahs of the onlookers massed on the sidewalks. From a window in the palace, Hindenburg looked down upon the marching throng, beating time to the military marches with his cane, apparently pleased that at last he had picked a chancellor who could arouse the people in a traditionally German way. Whether the old man in his dotage had any inkling of what he had unleashed that day is doubtful. A story, probably apocryphal, soon spread over Berlin that in the midst of the parade he had turned to an old general and said, "I didn't know we had taken so many Russian prisoners." A stone's throw down the Wilhelmstrasse, Adolf Hitler stood at an open window of the Chancellery, beside himself with excitement and joy, dancing up and down, jerking his arm up continually in the Nazi salute, smiling and laughing until his eyes were again full of tears. One foreign observer watched the proceedings that evening with different feelings. "The river of fire flowed past the French embassy," André-François Poncet, the ambassador, wrote, "whence, with heavy heart and filled with foreboding, I watched its luminous wake." Tired but happy, Goebbels arrived home that night at 3 a.m. Scribbling in his diary before retiring, he wrote, "It is almost like a dream, a fairy tale. The new Reich has been born. 14 years of work have been crowned with victory. The German Revolution has begun." The Third Reich, which was born on January 30, 1933, Hitler boasted, would endure for 1,000 years, and in Nazi parlance it was often referred to as the Thousand-Year Reich. It lasted 12 years and 4 months, but in that flicker of time, as history goes, It caused an eruption on this earth more violent and shattering than any previously experienced, raising the German people to heights of power they had not known in more than a millennium, making them at one time the masters of Europe from the Atlantic to the Volga, from the North Cape to the Mediterranean, and then plunging them to the depths of destruction and desolation at the end of a world war which their nation had cold-bloodedly provoked, and during which it instituted a reign of terror over the conquered peoples which, in its calculated butchery of human life and the human spirit, outdid all the savage oppressions of the previous ages. The man who founded the Third Reich, who ruled it ruthlessly and often with uncommon shrewdness, who led it to such dizzy heights and to such a sorry end, was a person of undoubted, if evil, genius. It is true that he found in the German people, as a mysterious providence and centuries of experience had molded them up to that time, a natural instrument which he was able to shape to his own sinister ends. But without Adolf Hitler, who was possessed of a demonic personality, a granite will, uncanny instincts, a cold ruthlessness, a remarkable intellect, a soaring imagination, and, until toward the end, when, drunk with power and success, he overreached himself, an amazing capacity to size up people and situations, there almost certainly would never have been a Third Reich. It is one of the great examples, as Friedrich Meinecke, the eminent German historian, said, of the singular and incalculable power of personality in historical life. To some Germans, and no doubt to most foreigners, it appeared that a charlatan had come to power in Berlin. To the majority of Germans, Hitler had, or would shortly assume, the aura of a truly charismatic leader. They were to follow him blindly, as if he possessed a divine judgment, for the next 12 tempestuous years. The advent of Adolf Hitler. Considering his origins and his early life, it would be difficult to imagine a more unlikely figure to succeed to the mantle of Bismarck, the Hohenzollern emperors, and President Hindenburg than this singular Austrian of peasant stock who was born at 6:30 on the evening of April 20, 1889, in the Gasthof zum Pommer, a modest inn in the town of Braunau am Inn, across the border from Bavaria. The place of birth on the Austro-German frontier was to prove significant, for early in his life, as a mere youth, Hitler became obsessed with the idea that there should be no border between these two German-speaking peoples, and that they both belonged in the same Reich. So strong and enduring were his feelings that at 35, when he sat in a German prison dictating the book that would become the blueprint for the Third Reich, his very first lines were concerned with the symbolic significance of his birthplace. Mein Kampf begins with these words. Today it seems to me providential that fate should have chosen Braunau am Inn as my birthplace. For this little town lies on the boundary between two German states, which we of the younger generation at least have made it our life work to reunite by every means at our disposal. This little city on the border seems to me the symbol of a great mission. Adolf Hitler was the third son of the third marriage of a minor Austrian customs official who had been born an illegitimate child, and who for the first 39 years of his life bore his mother's name, Schickelgruber. The name Hitler appears in the maternal as well as the paternal line. Both Hitler's grandmother on his mother's side and his grandfather on his father's side were named Hitler, or rather variants of it, for the family name was variously written as Hiedler, Hütler, Hütler with two T's, and Hitler. Adolf's mother was his father's second cousin, and an episcopal dispensation had to be obtained for the marriage. The forebears of the future German Führer, on both sides, dwelt for generations in the Waldviertel, a district in Lower Austria between the Danube and the borders of Bohemia and Moravia. In my own Vienna days, I sometimes passed through it on my way to Prague or to Germany. It is a hilly, wooded country of peasant villages and small farms, and though only some 50 miles from Vienna, it has a somewhat remote and impoverished air, as if the main currents of Austrian life had passed it by. The inhabitants tend to be dour, like the Czech peasants just to the north of them. Intermarriage is common, as in the case of Hitler's parents, and illegitimacy is frequent. On the mother's side, there was a certain stability. For four generations, Clara Pulzel's family remained on peasant holding number 37 in the village of Spittal. The story of Hitler's paternal ancestors is quite different. The spelling of the family name, as we have seen, changes, the place of residence also. There is a spirit of restlessness among the Hitlers, an urge to move from one village to the next, from one job to another, to avoid firm human ties and to follow a certain bohemian life in relations with women. Johann Georg Hiedler, Adolf's grandfather, was a wandering miller, plying his trade in one village after another in Lower Austria. 5 months after his first marriage, in 1824, a son was born, but the child and the mother did not survive. 18 years later, while working in Durenthal, he married a 47-year-old peasant woman from the village of Stronus, Maria Anna Schickelgruber. 5 years before the marriage, on June 7, 1837, Maria had had an illegitimate son whom she named Alois, and who became Adolf Hitler's father. It is most probable that the father of Alois was Johann Hiedler, though conclusive evidence is lacking. At any rate, Johann eventually married the woman, but contrary to the usual custom in such cases, he did not trouble himself with legitimizing the son after the marriage. The child grew up as Alois Schickelgruber. Anna died in 1847, whereupon Johann Hiedler vanished for 30 years, only to reappear at the age of 84 in the town of Weitra in the Waldviertel, the spelling of his name now changed to Hitler, to testify before a notary in the presence of 3 witnesses that he was the father of Alois Schickelgruber. Why the old man waited so long to take this step, or why he finally took it, is not known from the available records. According to Haydn, Alois later confided to a friend that it was done to help him obtain a share of an inheritance from an uncle, a brother of the miller, who had raised the youth in his own household. At any rate, this tardy recognition was made on June 6, 1876, and on November 23rd the parish priest at Dullersheim, to whose office the notarized statement had been forwarded, scratched out the name of Alois Schickelgruber in the baptismal registry, and wrote in its place that of Alois Hitler. From that time on, Adolf's father was legally known as Alois Hitler, and the name passed on naturally to his son. It was only during the 1930s that enterprising journalists in Vienna, delving into the parish archives, discovered the facts about Hitler's ancestry, and, disregarding old Johann Georg Hiedler's belated attempt to do right by a bastard son, tried to fasten on the Nazi leader the name of Adolf Schickelgruber. There are many weird twists of fate in the strange life of Adolf Hitler, but none more odd than this one, which took place 13 years before his birth. Had the 84-year-old wandering miller not made his unexpected reappearance to recognize the paternity of his 39-year-old son nearly 30 years after the death of the mother, Adolf Hitler would have been born Adolf Schickelgruber. There may not be much or anything in a name, but I have heard Germans speculate whether Hitler could have become the master of Germany had he been known to the world as Schickelgruber. It has a slightly comic sound as it rolls off the tongue of a South German. Can one imagine the frenzied German masses acclaiming a Schickelgruber with their thunderous Heils? Heil Schickelgruber! Not only was Heil Hitler used as a Wagnerian, pagan-like chant by the multitude in the mystic pageantry of the massive Nazi rallies, but it became the obligatory form of greeting between Germans during the Third Reich, even on the telephone, where it replaced the conventional hello. Heil Schickelgruber? It is a little difficult to imagine. Hitler himself seems to have recognized this. In his youth, he confided to the only boyhood friend he had that nothing had ever pleased him as much as his father's change of names. He told August Kubizek that the name Schickelgruber seemed to him so uncouth, so boorish, apart from being so clumsy and unpractical. He found Hiedler too soft, but Hitler sounded nice and was easy to remember. August Kubizek, The Young Hitler I Knew, page 40. Since the parents of Alois apparently never lived together, even after they were married, the future father of Adolf Hitler grew up with his uncle, who, though a brother of Johann Georg Hiedler, spelled his name differently, being known as Johann von Nepomuk Hüttler. in view of the undying hatred which the Nazi Führer would develop from youth on for the Czechs, whose nation he ultimately destroyed, the Christian name is worthy of passing mention. Johann von Nepomuk was the national saint of the Czech people, and some historians have seen in a Hitler's being given this name an indication of Czech blood in the family. Alois Schickelgruber first learned the trade of shoemaker in the village of Spital, but being restless like his father, he soon set out to make his fortune in Vienna. At 18, he joined the border police in the Austrian customs service near Salzburg, and on being promoted to the customs service itself 9 years later, he married Anna Glasselhörer, the adopted daughter of a customs official. She brought him a small dowry and increased social status, as such things went in the old Austro-Hungarian petty bureaucracy. But the marriage was not a happy one. She was 14 years older than he, of failing health, and she remained childless. After 16 years they were separated, and 3 years later, in 1883, she died. Before the separation, Alois, now known legally as Hitler, had taken up with a young hotel cook, Franziska Matzelsberger, who bore him a son, named Alois, in 1882. 1 month after the death of his wife, he married the cook, and 3 months later she gave birth to a daughter, Angela. The second marriage did not last long. Within a year, Franziska was dead of tuberculosis. 6 months later, Alois Hitler married for the third and last time. The new bride, Clara Pulzel, who would shortly become the mother of Adolf Hitler, was 25, her husband 48, and they had long known each other. Clara came from Spital, the ancestral village of the Hitlers. Her grandfather had been Johann von Nepomuk Hitler, with whom his nephew, Alois Schickelgruber Hitler, had grown up. Thus Alois and Clara were second cousins, and they found it necessary, as we have seen, to apply for episcopal dispensation to permit the marriage. It was a union which the customs official had first contemplated years before when he had taken Clara into his childless home as a foster daughter during his first marriage. The child had lived for years with the Schickelgrubers in Braunau, and as the first wife ailed, Alois seems to have given thought to marrying Clara as soon as his wife died. His legitimation and his coming into an inheritance from the uncle who was Clara's grandfather occurred when the young girl was 16, just old enough to legally marry. But as we have seen, the wife lingered on after the separation, and, perhaps because Alois in the meantime took up with the cook Franziska Matzelsberger, Clara, at the age of 20, left the household and went to Vienna, where she obtained employment as a household servant. She returned 4 years later to keep house for her cousin. Franziska, too, in the last months of her life, had moved out of her husband's home. Alois Hitler and Clara Pulzel were married on January 7, 1885, and some 4 months and 10 days later, their first child, Gustav, was born. He died in infancy, as did the second child, Ida, born in 1886. Adolf was the third child of this third marriage. A younger brother, Edmund, born in 1894, lived only 6 years. The fifth and last child, Paula, born in 1896, lived to survive her famous brother. Adolf's half-brother, Alois, and his half-sister, Angela, the children of Franziska Matzelsberger, also lived to grow up. Angela, a handsome young woman, married a revenue official named Raubal, and after his death worked in Vienna as a housekeeper, and for a time, if Haydn's information is correct, as a cook in a Jewish charity kitchen. In 1928, Hitler brought her to Berchtesgaden as his housekeeper, and thereafter one heard a great deal in Nazi circles of the wondrous Viennese pastries and desserts she baked for him, and for which he had such a ravenous appetite. She left him in 1936 to marry a professor of architecture in Dresden, and Hitler, by then chancellor and dictator, was resentful of her departure and declined to send a wedding present. She was the only person in the family with whom, in his later years, he seems to have been close, with one exception. Angela had a daughter, Gaily Raubal, an attractive young blonde woman with whom, as we shall see, Hitler had the only truly deep love affair of his life. Adolf Hitler never liked to hear mention of his half-brother. Alois Matzelsberger, later legitimized as Alois Hitler, became a waiter, and for many years his life was full of difficulties with the law. Hayden records that at 18 the young man was sentenced to 5 months in jail for theft, and at 20 served another sentence of 8 months on the same charge. He eventually moved to Germany, only to become embroiled in further troubles. In 1924, while Adolf Hitler was languishing in prison for having staged a political revolt in Munich, Alois Hitler was sentenced to 6 months in prison by a Hamburg court for bigamy. Thereafter, Hayden recounts, he moved on to England, where he quickly established a family and then deserted it. The coming to power of the National Socialists brought better times to Alois Hitler. He opened a Bierstube, a small beer house, in a suburb of Berlin, moving it shortly before the war to the Wittenbergplatz in the capital's fashionable West End. It was much frequented by Nazi officials, and during the early part of the war, when food was scarce, it inevitably had a plentiful supply. I used to drop in occasionally at that time. Alois was then nearing 60, a portly, simple, good-natured man with little physical resemblance to his famous half-brother, and in fact indistinguishable from dozens of other little pub-keepers one had seen in Germany and Austria. Business was good, and whatever his past, he was now obviously enjoying the prosperous life. He had only one fear, that his half-brother, in a moment of disgust or rage, might revoke his license. Sometimes there was talk in the little beer house that the Chancellor and Führer of the Reich regretted this reminder of the humble nature of the Hitler family. Alois himself, I remember, refused to be drawn into any talk whatsoever about his half-brother. A wise precaution, but frustrating to those of us who were trying to learn all we could about the background of the man who by that time had already set out to conquer Europe. Except in Mein Kampf, where the sparse biographical material is often misleading and the omissions monumental, Hitler rarely discussed, or permitted discussion of in his presence, his family background and early life. We have seen what the family background was. What was the early life? The early life of Adolf Hitler. The year his father retired from the customs service at the age of 58, the 6-year-old Adolf entered the public school in the village of Fischelham, a short distance southwest of Linz. This was in 1895. For the next 4 or 5 years, the restless old pensioner moved from one village to another in the vicinity of Linz. By the time the son was 15, he could remember 7 changes of address and 5 different schools. For 2 years, he attended classes at the Benedictine Monastery at Lambach, near which his father had purchased a farm. There he sang in the choir, took singing lessons, and, according to his own account, dreamed of one day taking holy orders. Finally, the retired customs official settled down for good in the village of Leonding, on the southern outskirts of Linz, where the family occupied a modest house and garden. At the age of 11, Adolf was sent to the high school at Linz. This represented a financial sacrifice for the father and indicated an ambition that the son should follow in his father's footsteps and become a civil servant. That, however, was the last thing the youth would dream of. Then, barely 11 years old, Hitler later recounted, I was forced into opposition to my father for the first time. I did not want to become a civil servant. The story of the bitter, unrelenting struggle of the boy, not yet in his teens, against a hardened and, as he said, domineering father, is one of the few biographical items which Hitler sets down in great detail and with apparent sincerity and truth in Mein Kampf. The conflict aroused the first manifestation of that fierce, unbending will which later would carry him so far, despite seemingly insuperable obstacles and handicaps, and which, confounding all those who stood in his way, was to put an indelible stamp on Germany and Europe. I did not want to become a civil servant. No, and again no. All attempts on my father's part to inspire me with love or pleasure in this profession by stories from his own life accomplished the exact opposite. I grew sick to my stomach at the thought of sitting in an office, deprived of my liberty, ceasing to be master of my own time, and being compelled to force the content of my whole life into paper forms that had to be filled out. One day it became clear to me that I would become a painter, an artist. My father was struck speechless. Painter? Artist? He doubted my sanity, or perhaps he thought he had heard wrong or misunderstood me. But when he was clear on the subject, and particularly after he felt the seriousness of my intention, he opposed it with all the determination of his nature. Artist! No, never as long as I live. My father would never depart from his never, and I intensified my nevertheless. One consequence of this encounter, Hitler later explained, was that he stopped studying in school. I thought that once my father saw how little progress I was making at high school, he would let me devote myself to my dream, whether he liked it or not. This, written 34 years later, may be partly an excuse for his failure at school. His marks in grade school had been uniformly good. But at the Linz High School they were so poor that, in the end, without obtaining the customary certificate, he was forced to transfer to the state high school at Steyr, some distance from Linz. He remained there but a short time, and left before graduating. Hitler's scholastic failure rankled in him in later life, when he heaped ridicule on the academic gentry, their degrees and diplomas and their pedagogical airs. Even in the last 3 or 4 years of his life at Supreme Army Headquarters, where he allowed himself to be overwhelmed with details of military strategy, tactics, and command, he would take an evening off to reminisce with his old party cronies on the stupidity of the teachers he had had in his youth. Some of these meanderings of this mad genius, now the supreme warlord personally directing his vast armies from the Volga to the English Channel, have been preserved. When I think of the men who were my teachers, I realize that most of them were slightly mad. The men who could be regarded as good teachers were exceptional. It's tragic to think that such people have the power to bar a young man's way. March 3, 1942. I have the most unpleasant recollections of the teachers who taught me. Their external appearance exuded uncleanliness. Their collars were unkempt. They were the product of a proletariat denuded of all personal independence of thought, distinguished by unparalleled ignorance and most admirably fitted to become the pillars of an effete system of government which, thank God, is now a thing of the past. April 12, 1942. When I recall my teachers at school, I realize that half of them were abnormal. We pupils of old Austria were brought up to respect old people and women. But on our professors we had no mercy. They were our natural enemies. The majority of them were somewhat mentally deranged, and quite a few ended their days as honest-to-God lunatics. I was in particular bad odor with the teachers. I showed not the slightest aptitude for foreign languages, though I might have had not the teacher been a congenital idiot. I could not bear the sight of him. August 29, 1942. Our teachers were absolute tyrants. They had no sympathy with youth. Their one object was to stuff our brains and turn us into erudite apes like themselves. If any pupil showed the slightest trace of originality, they persecuted him relentlessly. And the only model pupils whom I have ever got to know have all been failures in afterlife. September 7, 1942. To his dying day, it is obvious, Hitler never forgave his teachers for the poor marks they had given him. Nor could he forget. But he could distort to a point of grotesqueness. The impression he made on his teachers, recollected after he had become a world figure, has been briefly recorded. One of the few instructors Hitler seems to have liked was Professor Theodor Gissinger, who strove to teach him science. Gissinger later recalled, "As far as I was concerned, Hitler left neither a favorable nor an unfavorable impression in Linz. He was by no means a leader of the class. He was slender and erect, his face pallid and very thin, almost like that of a consumptive, his gaze unusually open, his eyes brilliant." Professor Eduard Humer, apparently the congenital idiot mentioned by Hitler above, for he taught French, came to Munich in 1923 to testify for his former pupil, who was then being tried for treason as the result of the Beerhall Putsch. Though he lauded Hitler's aims and said that he wished from the bottom of his heart to see him fulfill his ideals, he gave the following thumbnail portrait of the young high school student. Hitler was certainly gifted, although only for particular subjects, but he lacked self-control and, to say the least, he was considered argumentative, autocratic, self-opinionated, and bad-tempered, and unable to submit to school discipline. Nor was he industrious. Otherwise, he would have achieved much better results, gifted as he was. There was one teacher at the Linz High School who exercised a strong, and as it turned out, a fateful influence on the young Adolf Hitler. This was a history teacher, Dr. Leopold Pirch, who came from the southern German language border region where it meets that of the South Slavs, and whose experience with the racial struggle there had made him a fanatical German nationalist. Before coming to Linz, he had taught at Marburg, which later, when the area was transferred to Yugoslavia after the First World War, became Maribor. Though Dr. Pirch had given his pupil marks of only fair in history, he was the only one of Hitler's teachers to receive a warm tribute in Mein Kampf. Hitler readily admitted his debt to this man. It was perhaps decisive for my whole later life that good fortune gave me a history teacher who understood, as few others did, this principle of retaining the essential and forgetting the non-essential. In my teacher, Dr. Leopold Pirch of the high school in Linz, this requirement was fulfilled in a truly ideal manner. An old gentleman, kind but at the same time firm, he was able not only to hold our attention by his dazzling eloquence, but to carry us away with him. Even today I think back with genuine emotion on this gray-haired man who, by the fire of his words, sometimes made us forget the present, who, as if by magic, transported us into times past and, out of the millennium mists of time, transformed dry historical facts into vivid reality. There we sat, often aflame with enthusiasm, sometimes even moved to tears. He used our budding national fanaticism as a means of educating us, frequently appealing to our sense of national honor. This teacher made history my favorite subject. And indeed, though he had no such intention, it was then that I became a young revolutionary. Some 35 years later, in 1938, while touring Austria in triumph after he had forced its annexation to the Third Reich, Chancellor Hitler stopped off at Klagenfurt to see his old teacher, then in retirement. He was delighted to find that the old gentleman had been a member of the underground Nazi SS, which had been outlawed during Austria's independence. He conversed with him alone for an hour and later confided to members of his party, "You cannot imagine how much I owe to that old man." Alois Hitler died of a lung hemorrhage on January 3, 1903, at the age of 65. He was stricken while taking a morning walk and died a few moments later in a nearby inn in the arms of a neighbor. When his 13-year-old son saw the body of his father, he broke down and wept. His mother, who was then 42, moved to a modest apartment in Urfahr, a suburb of Linz, where she tried to keep herself and her two surviving children, Adolf and Paula, on the meager savings and pension left her. She felt obligated, as Hitler remarks in Mein Kampf, to continue his education in accordance with his father's wishes. In other words, as he puts it, to have me study for the civil servant's career. But though the young widow was indulgent to her son, and he seems to have loved her dearly, he was more than ever determined absolutely, he says, not to undertake this career. And so, despite a tender love between mother and son, there was friction, and Adolf continued to neglect his studies. Then suddenly an illness came to my help, and in a few weeks decided my future and the eternal domestic quarrel. The lung ailment which Hitler suffered as he was nearing 16 necessitated his dropping out of school for at least a year. He was sent for a time to the family village of Spital, where he recuperated at the home of his mother's sister, Teresa Schmidt, a peasant woman. On his recovery, he returned briefly to the state high school at Steyr. His last report, dated September 16, 1905, shows marks of adequate in German, chemistry, physics, geometry, and geometrical drawing. In geography and history, he was satisfactory. In freehand drawing, excellent. He felt so excited at the prospect of leaving school for good that for the first and last time in his life he got drunk. As he remembered it in later years, he was picked up at dawn, lying on a country road outside of Steyr, by a milkmaid, and helped back to town, swearing he would never do it again. He told this story on himself in one of his reminiscing moods on the evening of January 8th to 9th, 1942, at Supreme Headquarters. Hitler's Secret Conversations, page 160. In this matter, at least, he was as good as his word, for he became a teetotaler, a non-smoker, and a vegetarian to boot, at first out of necessity as a penniless vagabond in Vienna and Munich, and later out of conviction. The next 2 or 3 years Hitler often described as the happiest days of his life. "These were the happiest days of my life and seemed to me almost a dream." Mein Kampf, page 18. In a letter dated August 4, 1933, 6 months after he became chancellor, Hitler wrote his boyhood friend August Kubizek, "I should be very glad to revive once more with you those memories of the best years of my life." Kubizek, "The Young Hitler I Knew," page 273. While his mother suggested, and other relatives urged, that he go to work and learn a trade, he contented himself with dreaming of his future as an artist, and with idling away the pleasant days along the Danube. He never forgot the downy softness of those years from 16 to 19, when, as a mother's darling, he enjoyed the hollowness of a comfortable life. Though the ailing widow found it difficult to make ends meet on her meager income, young Adolf declined to help out by getting a job. The idea of earning even his own living by any kind of regular employment was repulsive to him, and was to remain so throughout his life. What apparently made those last years of approaching manhood so happy for Hitler was the freedom from having to work, which gave him the freedom to brood, to dream, to spend his days roaming the city streets or the countryside, declaiming to his companion what was wrong with the world and how to right it, and his evenings curled up with a book or standing in the rear of the opera house in Linz or Vienna, listening enraptured to the mystic pagan works of Richard Wagner. A boyhood friend later remembered him as a pale, sickly, lanky youth who, though usually shy and reticent, was capable of sudden bursts of hysterical anger against those who disagreed with him. For 4 years he fancied himself deeply in love with a handsome blonde maiden named Stefanie, and though he often gazed at her longingly as she strolled up and down the Landstrasse in Linz with her mother, he never made the slightest effort to meet her, preferring to keep her, like so many other objects, in the shadowy world of his soaring fantasies. Indeed, in the countless love poems which he wrote to her but never sent, one of them was entitled Hymn to the Beloved, and which he insisted on reading to his patient young friend August Kubizek, she became a damsel out of Die Walküre, clad in a dark blue flowing velvet gown, riding a white steed over the flowering meadows. Kubizek, who appears to have been the only friend Hitler ever had in his youth, has given in his book, The Young Hitler I Knew, an interesting picture of his companion in the last 4 years before, at the age of 19, he skidded down to the life of a vagabond in Vienna. A portrait, incidentally, that not only fills a biographical gap in the life of the German Führer, but corrects somewhat the hitherto prevalent impressions of his early character. Kubizek was as unlike Hitler as can be imagined. He had a happy home in Linz, learned his father's trade as an upholsterer, worked diligently at it while studying music, was graduated with honors from the Vienna Conservatory of Music, and began a promising professional career as a conductor and composer, which was shattered by the First World War. Although Hitler was determined to become an artist, preferably a painter, or at least an architect, he was already obsessed with politics at the age of 16. By then he had developed a violent hatred for the Habsburg monarchy and all the non-German races in the multinational Austro-Hungarian Empire over which it ruled, and an equally violent love for everything German. At 16 he had become what he was to remain till his dying breath, a fanatical German nationalist. He appears to have had little of the carefree spirit of youth despite all the loafing. The world's problems weighed down on him. Kubizek later recalled, "He saw everywhere only obstacles and hostility. He was always up against something and at odds with the world. I never saw him take anything lightly." It was at this period that the young man who could not stand school became a voracious reader, subscribing to the Library of Adult Education in Linz and joining the Museum Society, whose books he borrowed in large numbers. His young friend remembered him as always surrounded by books, of which his favorites were works on German history and German mythology. Since Linz was a provincial town, it was not long before Vienna, the glittering Baroque capital of the empire, began to beckon a youth of such ambition and imagination. In 1906, just after his 17th birthday, Hitler set out with funds provided by his mother and other relations to spend 2 months in the great metropolis. Though it was later to become the scene of his bitterest years, when at times he literally lived in the gutter, Vienna, on this first visit, enthralled him. He roamed the streets for days, filled with excitement at the sight of the imposing buildings along the ring, and in a continual state of ecstasy at what he saw in the museums, the opera house, the theaters. He also inquired about entering the Vienna Academy of Fine Arts, and a year later, in October 1907, he was back in the capital to take the entrance examination as the first practical step in fulfilling his dream of becoming a painter. He was 18 and full of high hopes, but they were dashed. An entry in the Academy's classification list tells the story. The following took the test with insufficient results, or were not admitted. Adolf Hitler, Braunau am Inn, April 20th, 1889. German, Catholic, father civil servant. 4 classes in high school, few heads. Test drawing unsatisfactory. Hitler tried again the following year, and this time his drawings were so poor that he was not admitted to the test. For the ambitious young man, this was, as he later wrote, a bolt from the blue. He had been absolutely convinced that he would be successful. According to his own account in Mein Kampf, Hitler requested an explanation from the rector of the academy. "That gentleman assured me that the drawings I had submitted incontrovertibly showed my unfitness for painting, and that my ability obviously lay in the field of architecture. For me," he said, "the academy's school of painting was out of the question. The place for me was at the School of Architecture." The young Adolf was inclined to agree, but quickly realized, to his sorrow, that his failure to graduate from high school might well block his entry into the architectural school. In the meantime, his mother was dying of cancer of the breast, and he returned to Linz. Since Adolf's departure from school, Clara Hitler and her relatives had supported the young man for 3 years, and they could see nothing to show for it. On December 21st, 1908, as the town began to assume its festive Christmas garb, Adolf Hitler's mother died, and 2 days later she was buried at Leonding beside her husband. To the 19-year-old youth, "It was a dreadful blow. I had honored my father, but my mother I had loved. Her death put a sudden end to all my high-flown plans. Poverty and hard reality compelled me to take a quick decision. I was faced with the problem of somehow making my own living." Somehow. He had no trade. He had always disdained manual labor. He had never tried to earn a cent. But he was undaunted. Bidding his relatives farewell, he declared that he would never return until he had made good. "With a suitcase full of clothes and underwear in my hand and an indomitable will in my heart, I set out for Vienna. I, too, hoped to wrest from fate what my father had accomplished 50 years before. I, too, hoped to become something, but in no case a civil servant." The saddest period of my life. The next 4 years, between 1909 and 1913, turned out to be a time of utter misery and destitution for the conquering young man from Linz. In these last fleeting years before the fall of the Habsburgs, and the end of the city as the capital of an empire of 52 million people in the heart of Europe, Vienna had a gaiety and charm that were unique among the capitals of the world. Not only in its architecture, its sculpture, its music, but in the light-hearted, pleasure-loving, cultivated spirit of its people, it breathed an atmosphere of the Baroque and the Rococo that no other city of the West knew. Set along the blue Danube, beneath the wooded hills of the Wienerwald, which were studded with yellow-green vineyards, it was a place of natural beauty that captivated the visitor and made the Viennese believe that Providence had been especially kind to them. Music filled the air, the towering music of gifted native sons, the greatest Europe had known, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, and Schubert. And in the last Indian summer years, the gay, haunting waltzes of Vienna's own beloved Johann Strauss. To a people so blessed and so imprinted with the Baroque style of living, life itself was something of a dream, and the good folk of the city passed the pleasant days and nights of their lives, waltzing and whining, in light talk in the congenial coffee houses, listening to music and viewing the make-believe of theater and opera and operetta, in flirting and making love, abandoning a large part of their lives to pleasure and to dreams. To be sure, an empire had to be governed, an army and navy manned, communications maintained, business